Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils pour la famille.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Neumann.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
It's exhilarating. It's like driving a car under an avalanche, but you're taunting the avalanche rather than trying to get away from it.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 8th of November, these are our main stories. A member of Israel's war cabinet says the country has no plans to govern Gaza, but will ensure it remains demilitarised after the war is over. The International Red Cross says a convoy delivering aid supplies has come under fire in Gaza City. At least seven people have been killed in an attack in the Afghan capital that appears to have been aimed at the ethnic Hazara community. Also in this podcast...
Weather and climate is what has caused these problems this year in both the northern and southern hemispheres.
Wine production around the world is expected to fall to its lowest level in more than half a century because of extreme weather. It's been a month since Hamas gunmen stormed across the border and attacked southern Israel, killing 1,400 people and taking more than 200 hostages. People across the country have observed a minute's silence, and a service for bereaved families has taken place in Tel Aviv. As Israel continues its retaliation against Hamas in Gaza, aid workers say a tragedy of colossal proportions is unfolding. Christian Lindmeier is a spokesman for the World Health Organization.
The level of death and suffering is hard to fathom. Over 1,400 people have reportedly died in Israel, and just over 11,000 have now been reported dead in Gaza. That's 0.5% of the population of Gaza. An average of about 160 children are killed every day. Nothing justifies the horror being endured by the civilians in Gaza.
A member of Israel's war cabinet has clarified comments made earlier by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the future of Gaza after the conflict. Ron Dermer, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, told the BBC that when Mr. Netanyahu said Israel would take overall security responsibility for Gaza, he meant it would ensure Gaza remained a demilitarized area.
The Prime Minister was not saying that Israel was going to reoccupy Gaza, or Israel was going to govern Gaza. You know, governance requires an administration that we assume will be Palestinian. You'll have to have internal policing, and there's a question of who will do that. You'll have to deal with reconstruction and how that would be done. There's a question of the overriding security responsibility. That's what he was talking about, to ensure that in a post-Hamas Gaza, we don't have the reemergence of a terror threat from in Gaza.
Earlier, the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant confirmed that for the first time in decades, IDF forces are now in the heart of Gaza City. He said the leader of Hamas in Gaza is surrounded in his bunker. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a TV address in Tel Aviv, where he once again rejected a ceasefire until all hostages have been released.
There will not be a ceasefire until all hostages come home. I would like to now speak to all the families in this ongoing nightmare that they are suffering. We are working in every possible way on every front in order to bring your cherished family members, our cherished family members, home.
I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, and asked him for more on the Israeli military advance in Gaza City. How in control are the IDF forces there now?
I think increasingly in control. We've seen pictures of Israeli armoured vehicles on the coastal road, right in the heart of Gaza. They say that they have established some kind of foothold, that they have destroyed a Hamas command center. And I think they are operating now across probably several parts of the wider Gaza City area. That's an area that includes not just Gaza City, but also two refugee camps. And so I think they are operating with increasing freedom, but this is a large area. It's a very built-up area. There are still, we think, potentially tens, if not hundreds of thousands of civilians there too, in addition to however many Hamas fighters are there. So I don't think any of us should think that the battle for Gaza City is going to be over anytime soon.
In terms of Benjamin Netanyahu on the TV, not really any new sentiment to his comments, but at least a hint of the possibility of a ceasefire or a pause if there is the release of the hostages.
That has been the Israeli position for some weeks now, that there is absolutely no prospect of a ceasefire unless Israel sees its missing hostages returned home. And not just that, but there isn't really much of a chance of even of a humanitarian pause, the phrase that the Americans coined some time ago, unless there's proper news of the hostages. The Israelis say, you know, we have to see the International Committee of the Red Cross being given access to the hostages. I think the Israelis know perfectly well that Hamas is not going to give that kind of access, but that is a demand they continue to make. And in the absence of that, we are seeing absolutely no let up in the fighting, either in terms of what's going on in the air or indeed the operations on the ground.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says a humanitarian convoy delivering life-saving medical supplies has come under fire in Gaza City. The organisation said two of five trucks were damaged and a driver was injured, but the convoy was able to deliver the supplies after changing its route. The ICRC's president had warned earlier on Tuesday that Israel's massive bombardment of Gaza was sowing the seeds of hardship for generations to come. Meanwhile, hundreds more Palestinians have been moving to the south of the territory. Our Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alou sent this report from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza.
Today we are having more people coming from Gaza City into the southern part. In fact, they were walking about 5 kilometers because the road leads to Gaza City was damaged, what's called Salah al-Din Road, which Israel advising people to take into the south. I have met some people who were like walking a very long way to make it because no access to the road. 1 month on, still Hamas able to fire rockets, still fighting going on in 8 different fronts in Gaza, especially in the northwest and southwest of Gaza, where Israel ground operation has been expanding and the grip around Gaza City has been tightening. And the humanitarian situation there is really at the catastrophic of hunger. I was talking to a father of 9 people there. You know, communication is very hard, but between time to time, we catch someone there. He said, I have no food, I have no money, and I have no water. There is no clean water because all of the aid that coming from Egypt, which is very little according to the UN, not reaching those about 500,000 people who live in Gaza City and the north. Here in the south, situation isn't better. It's quieter a little bit, less airstrikes, but the struggle to find food and water and the struggle for the hospital to find medicine is also continuing.
Our Gaza correspondent, Rushdie Abu Alou. More on the BBC Live page, bbc.com/news. Police in suburban Los Angeles have stepped up patrols around synagogues and mosques after a Jewish man died during clashes between pro- and anti-Israel demonstrators. Detectives are trying to establish how 69-year-old Paul Kessler came to fall and hit his head during a confrontation with a counter-protester. Here's our correspondent, David Willis.
Law enforcement officials say Paul Kessler, who was carrying an Israeli flag at the demonstration, died after being knocked backwards during a confrontation with a counter-protester and hitting his head. The protest is thought to have attracted around 100 pro- and anti-Israel demonstrators, and officials say they haven't ruled out the possibility of a hate crime. They've identified a suspect, but so far nobody has been charged in connection with the death.
The Taliban authorities in Afghanistan say at least 7 people have been killed in an explosion on a bus in the capital Kabul. 20 others were injured. Here's our South Asia regional editor and Barasan Ethirajan.
It was the third blast in less than a month in Dashti Bachi area of the Afghan capital dominated by the ethnic Hazara community. The Taliban say they are investigating. An explosion inside a sports club in the same neighborhood killed 4 people in late October. The Islamic State group said it carried out that attack. The UN Special Rapporteur, Richard Bennett, has called for a transparent investigation into the repeated attacks on the Hazara community.
Let's go to Portugal now, where the Prime Minister has resigned in connection with a corruption scandal. António Costa announced his decision on television just hours after prosecutors detained his chief of staff.
Today I was surprised with the officially confirmed information that criminal proceedings have been or will be brought against me. That's why, in my understanding, the dignity of the duties of Prime Minister is not compatible with any suspicion of his integrity. In these circumstances, I have obviously handed in my resignation to His Excellency the President of the Republic.
Our correspondent Alison Roberts is in Lisbon and told me more about those corruption allegations.
Mr. Costa has been in power as Prime Minister for just under 8 years, and this has really come as a complete bombshell. He himself said, as you heard there, that he was surprised by the information, and there were no leaks, as there often are in these kind of investigations. But the Attorney General's office this morning released a fairly lengthy statement saying that an investigation is going on into several major government-backed projects in some lithium mines in the north of Portugal, in a hydrogen-fired power plant, which is planned at a major port south of Lisbon, and also a data centre in that same area in the town of Sines. Now, the fact that the Prime Minister has apparently been caught up in some wiretaps, that's to say telephone conversations with a former minister or with current ministers, and that the information that was exchanged was of interest. As a result of that, he is now in a separate investigation, which is overseen by the Supreme Court because of the seniority of his government position. So although he is himself not an official suspect, he made a point of stressing that in his declaration to the nation. He said that it's incompatible with his remaining in his position as Prime Minister. But there are 2 ministers and 1 former minister who we understand have been named as official suspects. And also the Prime Minister's chief of staff has actually been detained along with 4 other people who are under investigation in this case.
Now, every country does this differently. So in Portugal, when the Prime Minister resigns, what happens?
So he submits his resignation to the president. And in this case, the president accepted it. So we can certainly say that he has indeed resigned. The president now has to decide what he should do. He said in the past, if this prime minister were to step down, in that case, it was in the context of him possibly going to some job as a European Union bigwig. If he were to step down, then he would dissolve parliament and call elections rather than, for example, waiting for the governing Socialist Party to put forward a new leader. So it's pretty much taken as given that he will call elections, but first he has to consult the parties and his Council of State.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. A ceremony has taken place in Singapore to announce this year's winners of the Prince of Wales's Earthshot Prize. This award honours people who are developing solutions for environmental problems, and each of the 5 winners gets £1 million towards their project, around $1.2 million. Our royal correspondent Daniela Ralph was at the ceremony.
On a stifling hot day in Singapore, interrupted by heavy showers, the Earthshot finalists mixed with celebrity guests on the green carpet.
Hello and welcome to the Earthshot Prize 2023.
Inside the awards ceremony, the Prince of Wales addressed the audience, warning that the climate crisis can't be ignored.
Our winners and all our finalists remind us that no matter where you are on our planet, the spirit of ingenuity and the ability to inspire change surrounds us all.
5 projects each won £1 million for their environmental solutions. They included a new way to build and recycle lithium batteries, which are used in electric vehicles, a forest protection scheme in the Andes, and WildAid, an ocean conservation project across the Americas, run by Megan Brosnan.
It's just really hopeful. It can be really lonely to do this work, and it makes you feel supported and lifted up.
The winners of the Earthshot Prize get more than just the money. They also secure access to the contacts and influence of Prince William, which past winners say has been invaluable.
Our royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph. Still to come?
The images beamed back by the Euclid Space Telescope provide a stunning new view of the cosmos. One shows the purple and pink clouds of the Horsehead Nebula, where stars are born.
The European Space Agency releases the first images from its unique space telescope as it continues to investigate the cosmic mysteries like dark matter.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Newman.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
Suddenly my quilt is ripped off me and then my room is full of white men. And I thought, I'm done for. These are fascists. They found where I live.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
I was just all alone in this vast, broken system.
I never gave up my dream.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Next to Sudan, where there are reports of widespread ethnic killings in the Darfur region. As fighting between the country's two rival armed groups continues, it's ordinary civilians who are caught in the middle. I've been finding out more from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
It is very difficult to get precise information as to what's happening, but certainly there have been some very disturbing reports from a place called Adamata, which is in an area that the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, have just taken over from the Sudanese military. Not clear whether there was a withdrawal or whether there was a proper fight for this place, but the RSF are now in charge. And civilians are saying that the RSF have been going around with their allied militias, basically looking for people who are from the Masalit ethnic group, and there have been many civilian deaths. There are photos on social media of bodies on the streets of Adamata, and that fits in with some of the other accounts from people who are talking about raids on homes. And this is a pattern we've seen in other areas that the RSF have taken over. And separately, we've just heard from Médecins Sans Frontières that just in the last few days, more people have crossed the border into Chad than during the entire month before that. 7,000 people just during the first 3 days of November, mostly women and children. So they're seeing a real upsurge in the violence, which seems to be coinciding with the RSF taking over these areas in western Darfur. That's close to Chad's border, and then people are fleeing across the border, but they really are trapped in these places. And many of them have been displaced for years and years because of the Darfur conflict that happened about 20 years ago.
Because the UN has been warning of a humanitarian disaster on this border between Sudan and Chad.
Yes, and there are ethnic groups that straddle the border, so some manage to seek shelter with relatives or people across the border who they have some links with. but there are also camps. But it's been a real struggle for agencies to help people, not only in Chad, but of course in Sudan itself, while the fighting has been going on.
And are there talks going on now to try to resolve this in some way?
There are talks going on, and we understand from these talks going on in Jeddah that there has been some kind of a breakthrough, in that the RSF and the military have agreed to allow humanitarian aid to flow and to kind of build up some trust-building measures between the two sides. But they've stopped way short of anything like a ceasefire, which is what everybody in Sudan would like. And there have been so many promises before out of talks of not only of ceasefires, but also, yes, we're going to allow in humanitarian aid, only for it to be far too dangerous and far too many restrictions to be put on the aid organisations to allow that aid to flow.
Will Ross reporting. Greenwashing is when an organisation spends more time and money on marketing itself as environmentally friendly than actually on minimising its environmental impact. And that's what a number of multinationals, Danone, Nestle and Coca-Cola, are accused of in a legal complaint to the European Commission by consumer and environmental groups. Julian Marshall heard more from Rosa Pritchard, plastics lawyer for Client Earth, one of the complainants.
The European consumer protection organisation BEOC, with the support of Client Earth and ECOS, and environmental organisations, has filed a complaint against three multinational fast-moving consumer goods companies that sell bottled water products for making claims about recycling on these products that we consider to be misleading. These are namely 100% recycled and 100% recyclable claims, and sort of different variations of these claims.
And you're arguing that this is not the case?
Yes, exactly. So we're arguing that there's a real risk that consumers are going to be misled by these claims. So firstly, there are kind of factual issues related to the claims. For example, if you take the 100% recycled claims and kind of, you know, variations of these claims, in any case, the full item that the consumer picks up off the shelf with the cap and the label included with the bottle is not fully made from recycled plastic. It's only one component of the beverage bottle that is. We also think this language around recyclability and 100% recyclable really risks misleading consumers and is ambiguous. But we often see also these claims are made with this kind of circular imagery of these like infinite loops, giving this impression of plastics going round and round or being recycled in an endless circle. And sometimes we also see the claims are being made with green imagery and sort of environmental statements as well. And that these really risk giving the consumers the impression that these plastic bottles can be a sustainable choice, can be a sustainable product and a sustainable choice. And clearly they have a significant impact on the environment.
You are mounting this complaint, this legal challenge, if you like, but these companies have been out there, according to you, making this 100% recycled claim for quite some time. How have they been able to do that?
I think kind of in general, we're getting increasingly used to seeing claims like this on products, particularly when it comes to the plastics problem. There's a huge amount of concern from consumers around plastic pollution. So that gives the consumer protection authorities obviously a lot of work to deal with to get on top of these claims. There are also really kind of technical aspects to these claims that you really need to go into some detail to explain the realities of the recycling system, that it's not necessarily everything that we think it is or that we would quite like it to be, or that sometimes companies give us the impression that it is. And that's why it kind of is so important in this context that the authorities really take action, because these claims really are very widespread. They are quite embedded and very common as well.
And have you made these complaints known to the companies themselves? And if so, what has been their response?
I believe there's been a response from Coca-Cola, in which it kind of states that it considers its claims to be substantiated, and it points to the importance of giving consumers information about recycling. Actually, on that point, that's really something that you know, we really highlight in the complaint, is really what matters here is that consumers have access to clear and very honest information about recycling. Really, what really counts is that we know we're given clear information about how to dispose of our products properly. And that doesn't require companies to make claims that might mislead consumers. It just requires them to simply give very clear instructions on how to properly dispose of a product in that particular market with its particular waste management infrastructure and realities.
Rosa Pritchard from Client Earth. The president of Chile, Gabriel Boric, has signed a new constitution and urged voters to take part in a referendum next month on whether to approve it or not. The document was drafted by an elected body over the past year. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
The current constitution dates back to 1980, when Chile was ruled by General Augusto Pinochet. Mr. Boric, a young left-wing leader, came into power promising to replace it. But a first attempt failed a year ago when two-thirds of Chilean voters rejected the new draft proposed by a left-leaning assembly, which was considered too radical. The latest draft protects private pension funds and says all illegal migrants must be expelled. But opinion polls say it's also likely to be rejected, which highlights Chile's deep political divisions.
Now, they say life's too short to drink bad wine, but now even bad wine could be in short supply, as production around the world is set to fall to its lowest level for over 60 years. France has overtaken Italy as the world's leading producer. I spoke to our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield and asked him what's to blame for this fall in wine production.
Climate, by which I don't necessarily mean climate change, though that might be a factor, but weather and climate is what has caused these problems this year in both the northern and southern hemispheres. Basically, what this body, the International Organization for Wine and the Vine, does is look at figures in for harvest this year. The southern hemisphere harvests, or 6 months ago, and the northern hemisphere just now, and makes predictions for how much wine will be produced. And it's found that in many countries in both hemispheres, bad adverse conditions, which can be drought, or it can be storms, or it can be hail, or it can be late frosts, which kill the young grapes, have meant there's been a big fall in likely wine production this year. Harvests have been very, very bad. For example, in Italy, it's down, 14%, 15%, and in Argentina, Australia, down by nearly a quarter. Only the US has done well in the northern hemisphere. France has held its own, but a lot of countries, like the ones I mentioned, South Africa, Chile, they've seen their production really, really fall, or likely production, because the wine hasn't been made yet, but this is based on the grape harvest.
If we're talking about oil, often producers like the fact that it's in short supply because it means they can put the price up. Does it work like that with wine?
Certainly. I mean, no one is necessarily saying this is bad news for the market. In fact, there are more saying that it is good news. I mean, the real problem is that, as everyone knows, certainly in Europe, has been massive overproduction of wine and the need to find some way of bringing it in. There's a glut. Some of it has to be held on the market here in Europe and not held off the market and be kept in vats. Governments pay farmers sometimes to destroy their wine. So this is not a bad thing from the market point of view, but it's merely interesting. And of course, it does raise questions whether this is to do with climate change. I mean, the many people are saying around the world that they can't prove a link. There's no question that extreme weather events are becoming more frequent, and that might be a factor.
Hugh Schofield with me from Paris. Next, the European Space Agency has released the first images from the Euclid Space Telescope, a European space project designed to investigate the cosmic mysteries of dark matter and dark energy. Over the next 6 years, Euclid will survey a third of the heavens to create what's been billed as the most accurate ever 3D map of the universe. This from our science editor, Rebecca Morell.
The images beamed back by the Euclid Space Telescope provide a stunning new view of the cosmos. One shows the purple and pink clouds of the Horsehead Nebula, a place more than 1,300 light-years away where stars are born. Another reveals the spiralling arms of what's nicknamed the Hidden Galaxy. It's usually obscured by our own Milky Way. Over the course of 6 years, the mission will survey 1.5 billion galaxies. Professor Isabel Hook is from Lancaster University.
We can see how good Euclid is going to be at detecting distant galaxies and how good its image quality is. And everything's working. I mean, that's pretty exciting in itself. So, it's really a huge breakthrough, and we're really pleased just to see these images, but to see how beautiful they are as well. It just adds the icing on the cake, really.
But it's not the aesthetic allure that astronomers are most interested in. Instead, they'll be scouring the images for the tiniest of distortions. They believe these could be subtle signals of two mysterious phenomena: dark matter, a ghost-like substance, and dark energy, a force that's causing the universe to expand at an ever faster rate. They're thought to make up most of the cosmos, but no one has ever seen them or really knows what they are.
Now back to our top story. Israel has been holding a day of memorial events to mark the Hamas attacks in the south of the country exactly a month ago. They killed more than 1,400 people. Flags were flown at half-mast. A minute's silence was held. The youngest son of the Shai family, Yoron, was an Israeli soldier on duty in the closest community to the Gaza Strip, which is called Kerem Shalom. He was killed on the 7th of October. We spoke to one of his brothers, Afia, a week later.
My baby brother died a hero under terrible, tragic circumstances, but my brother was one of the happiest kids I've ever met. He was hilarious. He was a clown. He had charm. He was a beautiful boy. He always had people surrounding him. Everybody loved him. He was the light in every single room. He would stay quiet for what seemed like an entire conversation. You think to yourself, is he zooming out? Is he, you know, trying to see the bigger picture? Or is he just not understanding anything that's going on around him? And then he would just come out with the funniest remark that lets you know he was listening. He was here this entire time. And he had this sort of sarcastic wit.
My colleague James Menendez caught up with Afia on Tuesday and began by asking how he and his family are coping 1 month on.
I think we all have been better. It looks online like some sort of trend or something nice to post about with some nice hashtags, but it's been a nightmare of a reality for us living through the last 30 days or so.
And how have your emotions changed over that time, do you think?
I think over time, a lot of the pain becomes mixed with a lot of great pride in what my brother did. He sacrificed his body and soul for the citizens of the state of Israel, protecting them from the atrocities we've seen in other parts of the areas surrounding the Gaza Strip. And I know that my brother saved hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians from that same exact reality. So I have a lot of pride in what he did.
So you still see him as a hero?
I think he's a hero. And, you know, he was always my hero. I think he's a national hero. I think he's honestly humanity's hero for what he did and, you know, the battle he stood for, the battle for the good side of humanity, the battle for protecting innocent civilian lives. That's what my brother died for.
Can I ask you this? Have you had moments at all of feeling angry that this happened at all? I mean, the attacks of October the 7th and the intelligence failures that went with it.
100%. Super, super angry. I know I don't represent just myself on this, that there's a lot of people who share the same exact anger and a lot of anger towards the terrorists who, you know, the absolute animals of human beings that were capable of doing something like this. So terribly angry.
And anger towards the government, the Israeli government as well?
I'm not super happy with them. I think we could have done better, especially knowing, you know, the Nazi ideology that Hamas and the people on the other side of the fence hold.
And what about the response since those terrible events of October the 7th? How do you feel about what's happened in the just over 4 weeks since then?
I think people have been calling for a ceasefire. On October 6th, there was a ceasefire that was completely broken in you know, the worst way possible on October 7th. And if you ask me, I am a loving person. I have nothing but peace in my mind. But until every single one of our children, women, elderly, and men come back from Gaza, there's nothing to talk about. I think Israel has every single right to defend itself, do everything in its power to bring back our people, bring back our civilians, bring back, you know, everybody who is currently held captive in Gaza back home.
Right. So about getting those hostages back. And do you think that the way that the operation is being conducted makes it more or less likely that they will all be able to return alive?
Listen, I'm not a general, nor am I a politician. So I really am not the right person to answer that question. All I know is my brothers and sisters are being held captive under Islamic jihadist rule, and I just want them back. and everything needs to be done to get them back.
What about the wider purpose of the operation? And I take what you say about not being a soldier, but you talked about having peace in your soul, and clearly no one wants anything like this to happen again in the future. Do you think the operation will achieve that it will make Israelis feel safe again?
I really hope to be safe again in my land. I really hope to raise my children in a safe Western democratic state, and I want them to be raised on liberal values of equality and justice. But for that to happen, we need to get rid of organizations like Hamas and every other, you know, extreme fascist ideology in this region.
And that was Ofir Shai, whose brother was killed in those Hamas attacks a month ago. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or on X, formerly Twitter, we are @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Newman.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.